I'm Sarah James, a lifestyle blogger and self-help aficionado.
And I'm Kristen Howerton, a writer and psychotherapist.
And you are listening to Selfie, a weekly podcast in the Life Listen Network about two women embarking on a self-care bender.
We're both of the opinion that self-care is important, and yet it's elusive. And while we may have all the information we need, we don't always get there.
We want to explore different aspects of self-care, from the silly to the serious, looking at body, mind, and spirit, and also just some random topics thrown in there for good measure.
We also want to look at the defenses and distractions that keep us from caring for ourselves like we should.
On today's episode, we are talking about sleep and how it can either make you the happiest person ever or make you feel like you're living in a personal hell.
This is true.
We are talking about introversion versus extroversion. And we're going to be looking into the Myers-Briggs personality test just a little bit. And we are also going to talk about women who shave their faces.
Kind of scandalous, but I'm actually super excited to talk about that one.
It's very popular. It's becoming all of the rage.
Oh, it's a thing.
It's a thing,
and it's a super fluffy topic, but I'm actually really excited to talk about it.
I am too. But first, we have to delve into the big topic, the topic du jour, sleep.
Sleep, which is a really big freaking deal.
It is such a big deal, and I feel like there's probably 100 podcasts out there that are solely devoted to sleep, so we're going to try to get as much in as we can, but... Yeah. I think last year, remember when Arianna Huffington's book came out?
Oh, yeah. She wrote a book about sleep. Well, first, I think the TED Talk was first. She did a TED Talk on sleep. It went crazy. Everybody was sharing it like, oh, my gosh. And then she wrote an entire bestseller on sleep, which I own and read. But, you know, it's so funny when we talk about sleep. It almost seems absurd because... it's a practically involuntary action. It's something everyone does. And yet it is super difficult for many of us.
Super difficult. And especially when you start hyperfixating on getting the right sleep. And she had some really compelling arguments in the book about how it's just truly paramount for your mental well-being, your emotional well-being, all of that. And she really basically said, by getting your sleep in order, you can, quote unquote, take back control of your life, which seems very dramatic.
It is very dramatic, but let's talk about some of those actual health ramifications. Like, let's talk about the science part of sleep for a second, and then I think we should dive into, you and I have both had really terrible experiences around sleep and insomnia, which I think is true for a lot of people.
But absolutely.
So... it's not just Arianna Huffington who believes that sleep is important. I mean, you know, national literature on sleep does indicate that it can affect everything from the way that our heart functions to our immune system. It can affect our weight, which is kind of scary, you know, and then obviously it can affect our emotions and our ability to regulate our emotions, our ability to think clearly, to process well. It's a big deal.
It is a huge deal. And I think all of the things you just mentioned, it's so true. And emotionally, physically, all of it, if you're not sleeping well, things are not good. Let's just put it that way.
Things
are not good. So when did you start experiencing issues with sleep?
Well, Sarah, sadly, I remember seeing a doctor about my insomnia when I was in grade school.
No.
So I have always struggled with sleep, with falling to sleep. I run anxious, which, you know, I think this is something that is relevant for a lot of people who deal with anxiety. But I always struggled with sleep, and I have ebbed and flowed throughout my life. And to be honest, before I had kids, I could kind of mitigate my sleep issues by I would just sleep in, you know. I might have trouble falling asleep, but I would sleep in.
Right, right.
But then once I had kids, it's like, you got to be up. You got to be up to take them to school. And so if you can't figure out your sleep issues, you're kind of in trouble. And so I can absolutely attest to sleep affecting my emotional stability. When I don't have enough sleep, I can spiral into depression and anxiety. I'm irritable with my kids.
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, I also think that any parent automatically deals with sleep issues.
Oh, absolutely. That first, well, they call it what? The fourth trimester. When you have this brand new baby that's on the clock feeding 24 hours a day, on and off. And for a lot of people who are lucky enough to not have dealt with sleep issues before, this is like throwing them to the wolves.
Yes.
And so there's all the hormones going on. Let's just take away all of what's going on in a woman's body after giving birth.
Which is a lot.
But then you throw not sleeping in there, and it's no wonder we're all walking around like absolute zombies.
Right. And zombies, but also we're emotional, and we are, you know, not thinking clearly, and we are maximizing, you are less able to deal with life's curveballs when you're running on less sleep.
You know, I've been lucky enough as a child, and really almost all the way through college in my 20s, I slept pretty well. It wasn't something I ever really thought about. I just went to sleep. I woke up. I've always been a really super early riser, but it was not an issue I had until the summer of 2013. I remember it so vividly.
Well, I remember it too, Sarah. You know, it's funny because I do feel like, just, you know, to give a little backstory to our friendship, I do feel like that was probably when we started getting closer.
Yes.
Because you were really dealing with insomnia in a horrible way, and I had dealt with it too. And so, you know, I feel like a marker in our friendship where, you know, we kind of dived a little deeper into, you know.
It threw me for an utter loop. Essentially, what happened was one night in June, I didn't sleep. And I woke up the next morning and thought, well, that's kind of odd. And I kind of feel like right now, but, you know, getting on with my day. And then the next night, I didn't sleep. And then the next night, I didn't sleep. And it turned out that entire summer, I didn't sleep. I would pass out from exhaustion at 5 a.m. and then I'd get up with my kids at 6:30. And it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And you know me, Kristen, I read all the books. I saw all the doctors. I took all the supplements. I did the meditation.
You did.
I did it all.
You did everything.
And I could not go to sleep. And it was completely baffling. And now looking back, I think it was definitely something chemical that just, you know, it's like a switch in my brain went off. But it was so scary. And it actually led me down a horrible period of my life of anxiety and depression that I didn't come out of till a year later. I started sleeping, you know, about 3 months later, but that was kind of the start of just all the mental distress that not sleeping for 3 months will do to a person. Talk about torture.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And that is what it feels like. I mean, if anyone's dealt with insomnia, or even if you dealt with a situation where you couldn't sleep, whether it was your kids kept waking you up in the middle of the night or a barking dog, it does feel torturous. And in fact, it is a form of torture. Sleep deprivation literally is a form of torture.
It
really can mess with you.
And I think the answer is different for everyone, because I'm sure people are wondering, well, like, what happened?
What happened to make you, Sarah?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. Well, you know, after my 1,000 books that I read and all of my supplements, literally lining my counters, my wonderful physician just said, we have to reset your brain. That's what's going to have to happen. And we have a chemical issue, and we're going to have to address it chemically. At that point, I was really spinning in an anxiety spiral. And she said, you need to take a Xanax, a very small dose of Xanax, before you go to sleep or before you attempt to go to sleep at night. And I think that's going to help curb this anxiety and this horrible, you know, cyclone that I had created in my own head. To which I responded, I could never take a Xanax, because if I do, I'll become addicted, and then I'll lose everything, and I'll end up in a sleeping bag underneath an underpass for the rest of my life, because, you know, I'll throw it all away. And I remember her looking at me and just saying, Sarah, you are the only person in Southern California that I'm going to have to beg to take a Xanax. But I pushed back, did I not? I pushed back for a month and a half. It was ridiculous.
Yes. I was asking you to get on the sedative train while too.
And it took me a long time. But finally in August, when I thought, okay, things are not good. I can't even relate to my family. I can't take care of my kids. I can barely drive. You can imagine, right? So I did. I took this little baby dose of Xanax, and what do you know? I fell asleep. And I had to do that for a couple of weeks to get my body right and my brain right again. And then when I was sleeping again, I just stopped taking them, and that was that.
But you know what? I do want to put on my therapist hat for a second, because your fears, while we are laughing about them, you know, I did work in recovery for a long time, and these sedatives like Xanax, Valium, Ativan, they can be very addictive. It's a tough balance to figure out, you know, how do I start to get to sleep, and do I need a sedative to do so if it's because my brain is running circles at night? You know, and so it's like, for some people, you can take a sedative for a little bit, kind of reset, get back. But for other people, it can become super addictive. Sedatives are hard. And then it's hard on the user end, too, because I also, like I said, have struggled with anxiety and insomnia my whole life. So when I go in and ask for a sedative, I'm sometimes treated like a drug seeker, you know? Yes. And they will look me up in the system and see how many I've taken in the past year. It's a controlled substance. It's a, you know, when you get that prescription, they can't call it in. You've got to carry that triplicate into the pharmacy. I mean, it's kind of a serious thing.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't want to, you know, while I would recommend that anyone who is really struggling with sleep talk to their doctor, you do have to be mindful of the exact same thing that you were mindful of, which is it could lead to bad things.
Yeah, here I'm not saying at all that it's not me. Xanax can be highly addictive. And, you know, you just have different personality types. And I think my doctor at that point knew me well enough to say, you don't have an addictive personality type for this kind of thing. I had like a little calendar.
You're so controlling.
I had like a calendar in my journal that I like mark a little X every time I took it. You know, that's not going to happen. But it is. But you're right. Even if you are going to use it responsibly, you're going to have to deal with that kind of feeling of shame. Like if I have to get a refill or something, you know, it's kind of like the head down. I don't know.
Totally.
But otherwise, it's not sleeping. And I am no physician, but I remember my doctor talking to me about the difference between that and, let's say, Ambien. And she said, you know, for her, it just felt, for my specific situation, to be the better choice, opposed to an Ambien that, you know, just can really knock you out. And the next day you're feeling completely groggy because it has a much longer half-life and all of those things. So, yeah, it's very much a personal decision.
Yeah, and let's talk quickly about the difference between the two. So as you mentioned, you know, an Ativan, Xanax, those are sedatives. So they have a shelf life in your body of about 4 to 6 hours in terms of, you know, kind of, slowing the brain down, slowing the anxiety down. So if you have sleep issues around overthinking at night, that would be good. But then there's Ambien or Lunestra, which are more for the entire night. You know,
exactly.
So if you have the issue of waking up in the middle of the night.
So I don't think did she talk much about pharmaceuticals in the book?
She didn't. She wasn't addressing so much folks like us who have insomnia. I think she was addressing more so the people, which is also me, who struggle with just the self-care aspect of sleep, of putting themselves to bed, which is hard, which is crazy because, like many self-care things, we know it's good for us. So why don't we do it? Why don't we put ourselves to bed at night?
Why don't we do that? And that leads right into her 12 tips for better sleep, which I think a lot of us have heard a lot of these tips over and over. And, you know, how they work for each person, it's just kind of a crapshoot. Obviously, keeping the bedroom dark, quiet, and cool. And I do think, you know, Kristen, we were talking about this a couple of days ago, that the bedroom is a very big deal. What's going on in the bedroom can really affect whether or not you're getting good sleep or not.
Yes.
So
I completely agree.
I like to keep it super cool in there, like really cold. I feel like I sleep a lot better in there. But the whole screen thing, you know, she talks a lot about, you know, no screens in the room at all. Charging.
Well, let's fess up. I mean,
do you
follow that?
No, because I'll tell you why. Because my iPhone sits right next to my bed because it's my white noise machine.
Yeah, I mean, I also have my iPhone right by my bed, which I know is, you're not supposed to do that.
Not supposed to do that. She says right here, even better, gently escort all devices completely out of your bedroom. But I will tell you, I am a white noise devotee. I love white noise.
We both are. We both love our white noise.
If something happens on my phone in the middle of the night and it stops, I will immediately wake up. which I don't think that's a good thing. I can't sleep without white noise. And my kids, my poor kids, they have white noise, so they'll probably never be able to sleep without it. But I just have to. I have to drown out all sounds. I'm a very light sleeper.
Yeah, I am very much the same way, which is nice when the times you and I have shared a hotel room, we both just turn it up super loud.
We do. It's like you walk into this like vortex of whoosh into our room.
Yes.
But it's very helpful. So, you know, she talked about keeping the bedroom dark, quiet, and cool. No electronics.
Not having a TV in the bedroom.
Right. I have a TV in the bedroom, although we don't watch a lot of TV at my house. Sometimes I'll binge watch a Netflix show or something like that. But I felt, especially when I was dealing with the insomnia, that the TV just kind of kept me from feeling super lonely and scared and lost in the middle of the night, which it probably wasn't a good idea, but I just felt so lonely.
I do think there is something to that. I think when you're really dealing with insomnia and you get woken up in the middle of the night and you start doing the countdown of like, no, I'm only going to get 4 hours of sleep, and your brain goes crazy. Sometimes you just need to watch a little, you know, Jimmy Fallon or something.
Exactly. It's more just getting your mind off of it, getting your mind off. Because that was, I think that is what drove me to complete madness, was I was so hyper fixated on the fact that I couldn't sleep. You know, I thought about it all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think, I don't know, like, I've always been anti-TV in the bedroom, too, just because I think it is a damper on intimacy. Because I think if you're falling asleep to TV shows, I don't know, like,
right,
you know, if you have a partner, it's probably maybe better to talk, have human interaction, do other bedroom activities. You know, I just think the TV becomes a way to avoid that.
Well, absolutely.
Connection.
And I think we've joked that, well, many people joke, my husband has what we call TV-induced narcolepsy. And any single time, he does. Anytime a show comes on the television or a movie screen or anything, he falls asleep within 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Even a Broadway play. So it doesn't have to be a screen so much. It's just, I don't understand what that is all about, but we don't have, that's a whole nother podcast. I don't really know what's going on with that. But you know, she said, once again, your bed is for sleep and sex only. No working in the bed. How many times, Kristen, have you possibly written a blog post while sitting in your bed? I know I have.
How many times have I recorded? I'm literally in my bedroom right now. I'm recording a podcast.
I know. Well, and I think that maybe we should touch back on this when we look into introversion, because I think that has a bit something to say. Dustin always makes it, my husband always makes the comment how I always kind of retreat into my bedroom, even like in the evenings. Because it's quiet, it's dark. I don't want to be around a lot of people or a lot of loud noises. So, but it is true. Sleep and sex only. That is what Mrs. Huffington says.
Well, that's what she says. Although I do want to make a small point here with her advice. A lot of it is steeped in privilege and assumes that you have the resources, the lifestyle. I mean, I do think a lot of people get sleep because their lives are such that they can't, you know, maybe they have, you know, a kid that sleeps in their bed, or maybe they have a job where they really have to work at night, you know. So I just want to honor that reality, too, that some of this is just not possible for everyone.
I think that's a really, really good point.
I think we tend to be performance over relationship, or achievement over relationship, which would be an interesting would be an interesting topic to look at. But, you know, I think our culture in America tends to be, we're looking at what have we done versus who have we connected with.
But I do have to say that I think that any sort of meditation, any sort of light yoga before you go to sleep, just kind of letting the body wind down is very helpful.
I agree, and it doesn't need to be a yoga class. You can do some stretches in your bedroom,
right?
Stretch, and I do think that what's funny is, I'm sure you did this too, but when my children were small, you know, we had a kind of a leading up to sleep routine, and so, you know, we'd give a bath and we'd read a book and they'd drink a special drink and we'd cuddle and then they'd go to bed. But it was, you know, a good 20, 30 minutes of leading up to sleep in order to ensure that they sleep well. And it's funny that we won't apply that to ourselves as adults.
Oh, absolutely not. And I think it goes right back to the performance.
We'll do all this for our kids. I know. And then, you know, I'll do all that for my kids. And then I'm like scrolling through Facebook in my bed and then like, wait, why can't I sleep right now? This very minute. Exactly. Of course I can't sleep right now.
No. And I think that just covers all of the issues right there with self-care and being a parent. Right. What you said, you could apply that to anything, that it's always, especially as moms, kids always coming first. Oh, my kids set. They've got everything going. Homework's done. Clothes are set out. We've got the lunches for the next day. Everything, you know, I'm giving all this, but, you know, that's about it when it comes to us. Because,
oh my gosh.
How much more can you give?
Totally. And that is absolutely my problem. I mean, something, and one of the compelling reasons that we wanted to do this podcast is I really find for myself, my self-care is the very last on the list. And my kids are well taken care of.
Right.
But myself, I am very last on the list. So it sometimes doesn't happen at all.
I've really tried to change that for myself the past year, and I've gotten a little bit better, and it's really interesting watching my kids watch me take care of myself. And, you know, because I think it conveys a very positive message to the kids that, you know, I'm taking care of myself too.
Yeah, I completely agree. And even on this topic, I mean, my mother did not have good self-care habits at all, but she really failed around putting herself to bed. And I remember my mom would stay up really late. She'd stay up late watching TV or playing solitaire on the computer. And she modeled that for me. She modeled, you know, doing distracting things instead of going to bed. And I think she did that because she was depressed and anxious, and she didn't want to be alone with her own thoughts, which I think is another reason some people stay up. You're running away from problems when you finally lay down to bed. That sometimes can be the time our brain taps us on the shoulder and goes, hey, like, remember this problem? Remember this thing you were trying not to think about when you watched Bachelor in Paradise for 2 hours?
Let's ruminate on that now at 1 a.m. Let's think about
totally.
It. Let's just think about it for a while.
100%. Which is why I do think that meditating during the day help sleep at night, because it forces you to kind of confront some of those issues that you may be pushing out of your brain all day long, so that it's not, because really I do feel like sometimes I have a come to Jesus moment when I lay my head down on the pillow, like, oh, all these things I haven't been thinking about today.
Oh yes. And you know,
all these problems.
When you mention meditation, it does make me think of, you know, the Calm app. Have you ever used that before? Okay. I love that app. I mean, I used Headspace for several years, and then I just kind of wanted a change. And I switched over to Calm, and that's what I use in the morning when I meditate. But they have really cool sleep stories on that app.
Yeah.
Have you seen those?
Yes.
Stories and such that you can kind of just drift off to at night. So it's not necessarily meditation in the traditional sense of meditating, but it is definitely takes your brain somewhere else. I love that app.
Yeah, that's a really good app. And you know what? We will pop that up on our website, selfiepodcast.com, if you want to check that app out. And we'll put a couple sleep apps up if you want to check them out.
Okay, so since we, you know, really like hanging out in our bedroom so much, this is probably the perfect time to talk about some introversion issues.
Well, you know what? To segue, I want to talk for a second. I want to get into the Myers-Briggs stuff, but I do want to talk for a second about introversion and sleep, because I think that this can be related, and I'll speak for myself as an introvert. I know often one of the reasons I don't put myself to bed is because I crave that alone time. And sometimes when everyone has gone to bed is the only time I can actually get it.
Yes. Yes. And that's, you know, it's funny because it is such a double-edged sword, because in essence, that is your own self-care, because you're giving yourself that time on your own.
It's what you need to refuel.
But it's keeping you awake.
It is.
And keeping you from sleeping. You know, how do you deal with that?
It's really tough because, you know, I will feel like crap all day long for not having gotten good sleep. And I'll tell myself all day, you've got to sleep tonight. Tonight you're going to sleep. And then everyone goes to bed and I get like my precious, like, my, you know, I am alone. I don't want to let go of this. I'm alone. You know, and it's so refueling. That time is so refueling.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to talk myself into, like, well, sleep is refueling too.
Oh, right, right. Because you don't have any alone time during the day.
No, I get scarcity model about it. Like, I want this time to myself. It'll never happen again.
Now, looking at the glass half full, optimist side, I would say that as your kids continue to get older, that's going to be something that you won't have to be dealing with as much because, you know, they're not going to want to be around you at all.
This is true. I just literally took my son to middle school for the first day and he could not have expressed more that he did not want my presence there.
Right.
Like he walked, I'm not kidding, he walked 10 feet ahead of me into the school because, you know, it's so embarrassing to have parents when you're in middle school.
Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Yeah, you don't want anyone to know you have parents. All right, so let's dive into a little further into personality types. And today we're going to look at introversion versus extroversion. So when we talk about personality types, we're going to talk for the next 4 weeks about the different Myers-Briggs personality types. If you've never taken a Myers-Briggs test, I highly recommend it. We're going to put a link up to a free online test onto our website at selfiepodcast.com. But Myers-Briggs looks at 4 different quadrants of personality. They look at the first is whether you're introverted versus extroverted. The second is whether you're intuitive versus sensing. And we're going to talk about that one next week because it's fascinating. The third is if you are a thinking or feeling person. And the fourth is whether you're judging or perceiving. And all of these together create your type. So, for example, I am an INFJ.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you, Sarah?
I'm an ISFJ. So we're very similar.
We're similar. So we're going to find out next week what that difference is between the two of us.
Also, we will put up the link to the Myers-Briggs test. There's a lot of different websites you can go to looking at this stuff. The one that I love is, have you gone to 16personalities.com?
It's my favorite.
It's my favorite because it's just, you know, some of them are very clinical and you can get really bogged down in the information. And this really just makes it really easy, bite-sized pieces to understand your personality. And the one thing I have to say quickly about Myers-Briggs that I have probably taken that test 7 or 8 times in my life, in all different times in my life. And I've always thought to myself beforehand, it's going to be different this time. And it has never been different. I have been an ISFJ since the first time I took it as a teenager. So it is really cool test. You guys really need to take it if you haven't taken it before.
Yeah, it really is. And it really ties into personality. Each of these facets of your personality tie into what kind of self-care you need and the struggles that you're going to face giving yourself that kind of self-care. So for example, introversion versus extroversion. Introversion doesn't mean that you're shy. It doesn't mean that you don't like being around people. It doesn't mean that you can't be the life of a party. And I think sometimes people confuse outgoing with extroversion and shyness with introversion.
Yes.
And it really isn't the case at all. People who are introverted, at the end of the day, it's about what you need to refuel. And introverts need to be alone to refuel.
Yes.
Is that true for you?
Absolutely. Now, I'm an ISFJ, which of the introverted types are the most extroverted introverts. So, for instance, I was in sales for almost 2 decades. I did really well as a salesperson. I would go out there, I can talk to anyone, you know, I can small talk, I can do it all. You would never think by meeting me that I am an introverted person. No one would ever think that. But for me, when I talk like that, it expels all of my energy. Whereas an extroverted person is at a party, the more people they talk to, they absorb others' energy. So they might leave a party feeling super energized, whereas I feel completely deflated and I have to go back and be alone to recharge.
Well, and I think this is why it's so fascinating to talk about personality types in the context of self-care, because self-care is really specific to each person.
Yeah.
And self-care to me looks like finding alone time, and self-care to my extroverted good friend looks like needing to make plans with girlfriends. And it's not that one is bad or not needed, but it's just like when it comes to your bucket is totally empty, you're at the end of yourself. If I'm at the end of myself, I have got to be alone.
To me, I am so introverted in that way that I can't even imagine going out and doing something. I remember coming home from sales conferences, and my husband knows I would not even speak for 2 days.
Yeah.
Literally, I felt physically ill. My body hurt. I was so achy just because it was so much that you're giving out. So I think it's really important how you point out it really has nothing to do with being perceived as shy or outgoing. It's really
absolutely. Yeah. And I think another example of that is you and I are both bloggers.
Yes.
And so, you know, we go to blogging conferences a couple times a year, and we often go to the same ones, and you and I both have a similar personality. So we will spend that time, and it's, I love being around other people. And so we, you know, I know you and I go to a blog conference, we hit the ground running, we're going to dinner, we're staying up late with our friends, talking into the wee hours, we're networking, we're passing out cards, we're shaking hands. And it's like, you and I can both do it, and we can pull it off, and we can seem very extroverted, but we will both have like a hangover.
Oh yeah. It, yeah,
like
absolutely.
An extroversion hangover.
It is an extroversion hangover. It hurts.
Yeah, we will get home and be like, no one look at me.
I know. I think that's so true. And it is interesting talking about how self-care looks different for each of that. Because so what I would love to hear, I don't know, on our website, selfiepodcast.com, if you want to leave a comment on this particular episode, but I would love to hear how extroverts feel it necessary to take care of themselves. Like, how do they do that? Is that just with other people around, or is it more alone? Because I feel like extroverted people would want to be out and around others, if maybe like going to a coffee shop and still being around the energy of others, but still relaxing. I don't know. Because me, I'm like, I don't even want to go to a coffee shop. I don't want to be around people. You know, my husband, it's really interesting because my husband is very reserved, but he is an extrovert.
Yes, I can see that.
He loves being around people, and he's very quiet. So he will go, I mean, airport, coffee shop, a mall, he loves, because he just sits back and takes it all in. Those places are hell on earth for me. I don't want to be around that much energy. I want to be alone in my room, like a hermit. Thank you very much.
I know. Isn't that so funny? And then I think for introverts who have children, there is that, you know, self-care and children, you know, we love our kids, you know, but children are rough on the self-care. And when you're an introvert, I know for me, I managed my introversion fairly well until I had kids. And then I was like, these people want to be around me all the time. I'm never alone.
The dreaded play date.
Oh gosh. And that too. Yes, that too. But I think that is why, you know, because I don't get that alone time that I used to get because I have kids, that's why I stay up too late. That's why I can sometimes hermit a little bit and avoid play dates or avoid, you know, the school pickups, because I'm just tapped out just from being a mom. My introversion limits have been reached just from parenting.
It's a lot. It's a lot, Kristen. It really is.
Well, like you said, it is getting better because they're getting older and they don't want to be with me as much.
Yeah. And it is about, oh my gosh, I really hate this word. I'm going to say it. Are you ready?
Oh no.
It is about the balance.
It's about the balance. What even is the balance? I think that's the critical question that we're exploring in this entire podcast. What's balance?
Oh, I know. We'll let you know when we find that out. Absolutely.
I know. We'll figure that out.
Okay. So is it time to talk about some face shaving?
I think we're ready to talk about shaving faces.
Okay. Let's talk about face shaving.
So now, we just want to clarify, we're talking about lady face shaving.
Lady face shaping.
Okay, Sarah, why would someone do this?
Okay, let me first point out that women have been doing this for decades, for centuries. Women have been doing this. This is nothing new. It's not really so much an American thing to do, but people all over the world have been doing it. And Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor, they shave their faces, people. They shave their faces. So I heard about it the first time, probably 5 or 6 years ago. I had this beautiful, when I live in Southern California, my friend Gretchen. I was in my late 30s. She was in her middle 40s, early to mid 40s. And one night we were having cocktails and she told me that she shaved her face. And I didn't even know how to react to that. But she had the most gorgeous skin. I have to tell you that. Just so clear and smooth. And she was 44. So I said, please do tell. Tell me some more. And she told me that she just would go buy those big bags of Gillette razors. You know, those like old school little blue ones that are disposable.
Yeah. And the ones you get in a hotel when you forget your razor.
Totally. And she just go at it on her face. And I said, well, do you have a hairy face? Is that the issue? She said, no, this is all about exfoliating your face. So it turns out that when you shave your face, it is like the best exfoliation you could possibly do.
And because you're taking off a layer of skin.
You're
basically
taking off the dead cells of the skin. And there is an argument that men's faces age better than women's because they shave their faces.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is that why men, you know how we get the like pucker wrinkles? You know the ones I'm talking about around your lips? What are those called?
I know, just kind of like those kissy wrinkles right around the lips. Yeah.
Like women get those way worse than men. Is that why?
Well, it could be possible. Now, you know, I haven't done any scientific study myself on the subject, but that is the argument. So also removing all of that. So they call it vellus hair, which is just basically peach fuzz, right? I don't have any hair on my face that is like the hair on my head, but I do have white, really fine peach fuzz all over my cheeks that, you know, if you're like in a certain light, you can kind of see it right there. So by removing the hair from the face, not only are you exfoliating it, but it leaves a perfectly smooth canvas for makeup application, for your skincare to absorb into the skin, like serums or oils or, you know, treatments you use after you wash your face. It absorbs much easier because you don't have that vellus hair. So I don't know. People are loving it. Doctor's office do it. They call it dermaplaning because they want to make it sound, you know, way more serious. And it is a little more intense in a doctor's office.
Well, but I actually have a friend who is a licensed cosmetologist and we were having a girl's night and she dermaplaned a few of our faces.
She did it?
Yeah. And so it is a little different in that it's a pretty serious razor, almost more like a surgical razor. And I think, you know, all of our faces were a little pink after. So it didn't feel like it was heavier duty. I think it was taking off a little bit more than, you know, a drugstore razor would.
I agree. I think that they use a 10-inch scalpel and it like has that sharp point on the end.
It does.
Yes. So the ones that are the most popular to use, I can't even say this without laughing. Why would anyone name their razor this? But they're called the Tinkle razors.
Well, let me just tell you, I know about the Tinkle razors because I'm a little scared that I'm now mentioning the show The Bachelor twice in a self-care podcast. But you know what? You got to do what you got to do, ladies. But one, Michelle Money, who is a longtime Bachelor veteran, did a video shaving her face with the Tinkle. And I was like, what? But she says the same thing, that it takes the hair. Well, she does it because she thinks no one should have the peach fuzz.
Right.
Which I don't know. I'm kind of like, listen, like, that's just a little too far that we have to take off all the peach fuzz.
I agree.
But yeah, she uses the Tinkles.
She loves the Tinkle. And I laugh because that was the very first video when I started my extensive research on face shaving. That was the first video I saw was Michelle Money.
Well, it has like millions of views. So obviously people are interested. I mean, I think that this is interesting to people for, you know, the skincare reasons. But I also think a lot of people are interested in this topic because they have facial hair to remove. I mean,
yes,
a lot of women remove their facial hair, whether it be, you know, a little too much eyebrows or a mustache or what I have now that I've hit past 40. I only had peach fuzz before, but once I hit, well, this probably started in my late 30s, I have like white whiskers. So the peach fuzz turned into like wiry gray hair white hair that like glistens in the sun.
Where?
So on my chin.
On your chin, like on the bottom of your chin?
on my chin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nasty. It's super, super unflattering. So I don't know. I can't get my head around the idea of shaving like a man, like shaving that hair off. So I usually just pluck it. But I don't know, I think it's me just going like, I don't know. Like, I remember my Aunt Vi shaving her face. Like, I can't.
Know it's hard to get past that. And then plus the fears, which are untrue fears, but they're the fears that the shaved hair will grow back darker or coarser or faster, which that's simply not true. When you shave, it doesn't change the number of your hair follicles. It doesn't change the way the rate or the growth of the hair. So like that's what can happen. But
okay, that may not happen, but if you have wiry or thick hair on your face and you do the face shaving, it will feel like stubble as it grows in, which if you're making out with someone might be off-putting if they're feeling your stubble.
And I think that's what's holding me back. I mean, not the making out part, but I know as a fact that's not going to happen. And all I have is just this peach fuzz that no one else really sees. I'm just afraid. I don't know. Like when it grows back. Because when you cut it off bluntly on the edge, it does come out blunt. You don't have that fine tip like you do when it's growing out. So I don't know, Kristen.
Well, have you tried the tinkles yet? Have you tried them?
Girl, no. I bought them, but I just stare at them. I just stare
at
them.
You gotta try them.
I on my face?
Yes.
I don't know.
That's why you bought them?
Well, I know. I'm just waiting for more people to do it.
Oh, you're so funny. Well, I've tried it. I bought them. I tried it. So I will say the peach fuzz regrowth is really unnoticeable, at least for me.
Okay.
It doesn't feel like, stubble or like your legs do. For me, the peach fuzz on the side of the face was fine, grew back in, whatever, nothing. I don't think I would probably do it again because I don't really care about that hair.
Right.
But if you do the tinkle over, like chin hairs or mustache, if you have like, coarser hair, that does grow in kind of weird.
Okay. Well, this
like
is
stubbly.
Good. This is good information to know.
But you gotta try it, Sarah.
Well, I would. I mean, just because, what I do for, I'm a green beauty blogger. So I try all of this natural skincare all day long to write about. And I'm very intrigued by the thought of not having any peach fuzz and having that product be able to penetrate more readily. So I'm getting close. I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
See, this is why it's fun that we're doing this podcast together, because this is a personality difference. You will research the tinkle, you'll buy it, but you'll continue your research. And maybe in 5 months you will have read enough to try it. And I will see a video by someone who was on The Bachelor and I'll order it on Amazon and try it the day it comes. Like, okay.
I know.
I'll do this.
This is so me. This is me. This is Sarah. This is what I do. I research the crap out of things.
I have
a lot of information in my head that needs
you
to come out. But it might be good to, be practical and actually do it. One day, maybe.
I think you should try it. Well, I will say, being impulsive doesn't always work out, because on the tip of hair removal, the other day I bought wax strips to deal with my little chin whiskers.
Okay.
And I did the chin whiskers. And then, of course, what happens when you have wax strips out, you just go, I'm going to do more things.
Oh, no.
So then I start waxing my entire face. I waxed the peach fuzz just because, which again, I actually don't care about the peach fuzz. I just think life is life, whatever.
Right.
People are hairy. But I waxed all that. And then like over the next week, I got totally broken out.
No.
Like all these like whiteheads from waxing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I would not recommend waxing off your peach fuzz, A, because it hurts, but B, because it could break you out. And also, can we just all agree that we can have peach fuzz, like that's not a new thing that we have to remove?
I'm tired. Can we please? I mean, we have to remove everything else. Can we leave the peach fuzz?
Just leave us our peach fuzz. I'll get the whiskers off the chin, but I'm just, the peach fuzz is staying.
Save the peach fuzz. Okay, so Should we talk about what we're talking about next week?
Yes, you guys, we have many things to discuss next week. Next week, we are having the period episode.
Oh, I mean, ladies, hold on to your horses.
Get ready. I have to say, I feel like every time I'm around a group of women, we start talking about periods. And there's so much to say there from the emotional aspect of periods. And it's funny, I had a friend just this week post about how she would hide the tampons from her husband when she got her period because she didn't want him to know that the fight they had the night before was really just PMS.
Oh, girl. For the longest time, I thought that was just some crazy construct. I was like, there is no such thing as PMS. And then I had kids, and now I am, 42. We're talking, I am in perimenopause land right now, and it is going down.
It is.
Look out.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh my God.
We have a lot to say on the perimenopause,
Oh, yeah. So,
yes.
Join us.
Much to say on the period episode. Then we're also going to be talking next week. We're going to dive a little bit deeper into that second quadrant of the Myers-Briggs personality, which is intuitive versus sensing, which is the one Sarah and I are different on. So we'll talk about that.
Yes. And then finally, how about a little brow shaping for dummies?
We're going to talk about brow shaping. I have a lot to say about that, too, because my brows are white.
Do an excellent job, and you're gonna have to roll with that because you know me with the bangs. I don't even know what my brows look like. They're just hidden back there, which is a good thing.
My brows are a lot of work. They're non-existent, and then they're white, as in like gray white. So I will give much advice.
A random mishmash.
Yes, all relating back to self-care in some way or the other.
Thanks for joining us. Continue the selfie conversation with us on Instagram at Selfie Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/selfiepodcast.
You can also visit our website to check out the resources we've talked about in each episode at selfiepodcast.com. Make sure to subscribe to Selfie on iTunes so that you can catch up with us next week.
A huge thanks to Shepherd Audio for our intro music. Take care.